Translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada. After inquiring about proper self-knowledge from the great philosopher son of Vyasadeva, he will renounce all material attachment and achieve a life of fearlessness. So here you can see this verse is a continuation. We had the Brahmins, astrologers. They were telling Maharaj Yudhisthira that Maharaj Purkit would be a great devotee. Then they also set out he would be very good in his service as a kshatriya. They're going through all of his kshatriya qualities. Then they're discussing how he's going to die, how he's going to be cursed, how he's going to take shelter of the big Ganga, right? How he's going to surrender, and what is the result of surrender? Because a person may say, well, all right, so many people so-called surrender, but do they actually achieve perfection? And here it's explained how he's going to achieve perfection. Akuta Bhaya. He's going to achieve a life of fearlessness. Purport. Material knowledge means ignorance of the knowledge of one's own self. That's quite a sentence right there. Material knowledge means ignorance of the knowledge of one's own self. So-called knowledge is actually ignorance. Philosophy means to seek after the right knowledge of one's own self, or the knowledge of self-realization. Without self-realization, philosophy is dry speculation or a waste of time and energy. Srimad Bhagavatam gives the right knowledge of one's own self, and by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, one can get free from material attachment and enter into the kingdom of fearlessness. So far, Srila Prabhupada is explaining what is real knowledge. Real knowledge is realizing yourself, actual realization. And he says here, if you don't have self-realization, if you don't realize yourself, then you're wasting your time. The Srimad Bhagavatam will give us knowledge of our own self. And then, with knowledge of our own self, what do we achieve? What are the symptoms? We give up material attachment and we attain fearlessness. Okay, going on. This material world is fearfulness. Its prisoners are always fearful, as within a prison house. In the prison house, no one can violate the jail rules and regulations. And violating the rules means another term for extension of prison life. Similarly, we in this material existence are always fearful. This fearfulness is called anxiety. Everyone in the material life, in all species and varieties of life, is full of anxieties, either by breaking or without breaking the laws of nature. Liberation or mukti means getting relief from these constant anxieties. This is possible only when the quality of anxiety is changed by the devotional service of the Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam gives us a chance to change the quality of anxiety from matter to spirit. Those are also these two sentences. I'm going to read those again because they're so surprising. This is possible only when the quality of anxiety is changed by the devotional service of the Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam gives us the chance to change the quality of anxiety from matter to spirit. This is done in the association of a learned philosopher like the great self-realized Sukadeva Goswami, the great son of Srila Vyasadeva. Maharaj Purkit, after receiving warning of his death, took advantage of this opportunity by associating with Sukadeva Goswami and achieved the desired result. So here Prabhupada is giving us the key to how to achieve fearlessness. He gave us two things: hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and associating with a person such as Sukadeva Goswami, which, of course, if you hear Srimad Bhagavatam, you're doing both at once. So now Srila Prabhupada is going to explain how you could hear Srimad Bhagavatam without associating with Sukadeva Goswami. In other words, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam is not an automatic association with Sukadeva Goswami or an automatic grantor of fearlessness. There's a caveat here. Read this last paragraph. There is a sort of imitation of this reciting and hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam by professional men. And their foolish audience thinks that they will get free from the clutches of material attachment and attain the life of fearlessness. Such imitative hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam is a caricature only, and one should not be misled by such a performance of Bhagavatam Saptaha undertaken by ridiculous, greedy fellows to maintain an establishment of material enjoyment. Oh, that's so funny. Ridiculous, greedy fellows. Jignasi tatma yatartyo munir vyasa sutada shau hit vedam ripagandayam yasyad adha kuto vayam. After inquiring about proper self-knowledge from the great philosopher Sundar Vyasadeva, he will renounce all material attachment and achieve a life of fearlessness. Prabhupada says here, the material world is fearfulness. Everyone in the material life, in all species and varieties of life, is full of anxieties. Prabhupada says these anxieties are constant. They're constant. I mean, if we just are a little honest about what our day is like, if we're in materialistic consciousness, we're always worried about something. Right? And as soon as one worry is over, then there's another worry. I'm worried about my relationship with my employer. And then that's settled. And then I'm worrying about my relationship with a client or a coworker. Then that gets settled. Then I'm worrying about my relationship with my spouse. I'm worried about a leak in the roof. And that gets fixed. That gets fixed. Then I'm worried about the insurance on the car. And then I get a notice in the mail that I could save on my mortgage. So I start worrying about that. Then I worry about my health. I worry about how my children are doing. I worry about the government. Now, if you keep up with the news at all, and of course, Srila Prabhupada also kept it with the news for preaching, but if you keep up with the news is full of so many reasons to be in anxiety. I mean, anxiety about the weather, changing climate. I'm in anxiety about the economy. Maybe I won't have enough money. They say that people's biggest anxiety is that they're going to run out of money before they run out of life. Worry about, do I have enough money to get what I want, what I need? Will I be taken care of? Everyone worries about war, terrorism, bombs going off, people getting shot, crime, locking my house, locking the car, locking my suitcase. Constant. Prabhupada says it's constant. And we're thinking, okay, as soon as I take care of this problem, then I'll be able to be peaceful and focus on Krishna. And lo and behold, another problem comes along. Little ones, big ones. My wife's been out shopping for a long time, and she left her phone at home. Did she get in an accident? How am I going to bring up this sensitive issue to the temple president? He might get angry, and then I might not be welcome at the temple anymore. I wouldn't be able to do any service. Oh, big ones. Do I have cancer? What am I going to do with my son, who's a heroin addict? That one Russian lady who has one child often talks to me how he's a heroin addict and she doesn't know what to do. So little anxieties, big, and it never ends. Never ends. The mind is constantly presenting us with one thing to worry about after another, after another. That's the business of the mind, actually, to distract us from Krishna. It's like if you have a little, very little baby, and they want to play with something. You don't want them to play with it. So you keep distracting them. Oh, look over here. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? So when one wants to forget Krishna, then Krishna very kindly gives us a covering of mind, which is always facilitating our desire to forget Krishna. Look at this. Think about this. Worry about this. This is so important. You've got to worry about this. You've got to be afraid of this. And people relish this fear. I mean, at least you're feeling something. At least when you're in anxiety and fearful, you know you're alive. Some sense of existence. So people actually increase their fears. They read the news to increase their fear. They watch scary movies and read scary books to increase their fear. Go on amusement park rides to increase their fear. Have discussions with each other. What about this? What about that? This might happen. Wow, there's this conspiracy theory. Everybody's out to get me. Right? To increase their fear. This is the essence of material life, is being afraid. Why are we so afraid? We have a false identity. I'm thinking on this body and this mind, and this body and this mind are pretty fragile. You know, have a material body, especially an earth body, earth human body, it's pretty fragile. You know, just a little slip on the stairs and you've broken a bone. Just, you know, don't be so careful with what you eat and drink, you get sick. A little contact with another sick person, you get sick. So delicate. Everything's such a, just get in your car. Everyone has, what they say, a 1 in 3 chance of getting into a major car accident in your life. Like a drop of water on a waxed lily leaf. If you don't see any wax lily leaves, if you have like some waterproof clothes, you know, if it gets water on them, an umbrella, the water just beads up and falls off. So if we're invested in this body, if we're invested in the things of this world, we must have concomitant fearfulness. Therefore, Krishna talks twice in the Gita about attachment, fear, and anger. If this is me, and this is my things, and this is the source of my happiness and the source of my life, then I'm going to be constantly afraid. I'm going to be afraid, will I get what I need? Will I get what I want? Will someone else stop me from getting what I want? Will something stop me? And once I have what I want, I'm afraid of losing it. Sochati kanchati. I'm hankering for what I don't have, or I'm hankering to keep what I have. I'm lamenting for what I've lost, and I'm lamenting even for what I will lose. I'm lamenting in advance. So mostly lamenting is for the past, hankering is for the future. I'm absorbed in the past and the future. I meditate on all the ways in which I suffered in the past, and I resolve that I'm not going to suffer in the future. I'm going to be happy by making this arrangement, that arrangement. In this way, I'm completely enveloped by illusion. I think I'm something that I'm not. Dehi no smin yata dehe komram yoganam brahante dehantarap tarap trap here dearest tatra adhira, a sober person knows. I'm not this body. But if I think I'm this body, if I think this is my family, this is my home, this is my job, these are all the sources of my pleasure. My family, my clothes, my food, my books, my car, my house, my community, my society, my country. This is what's going to give me security. This is what's going to give me pleasure. This is what's going to give me understanding, power, influence, meaning. And it's because it's all an illusion, it has nothing to do with me. I'm constantly in anxiety. And I'm enveloped by time. Hankering and lamenting at time. Lamenting for what has happened in the past. And hankering for what I want to get in the future. But you know, the only thing that exists is the present. This concept of time with past, present, and future. This is the first element of material illusion. You know, there's never a future. Future never comes. When we worry about the future, we are the least in touch with spiritual life. At least the past had some existence. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, forget the past that sleeps and there the future dream at all, but dwell with times that are with thee and progress we shall call. When the mind tells us to worry about past and future, we're in an illusion. Distracts us from the present. Instead of being attentive to what service I have to do now, how I'm connecting with Krishna now, I worry about other things. I become filled with anxiety about something that doesn't even exist. This is the basic material problem, this fearfulness. Of course, fearfulness is also tied to defense. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So that our conflicts, adidaivik, adiatmik, adivortik, we're constantly thinking that we're being attacked. We think that the material energy is attacking us, therefore we are defending and counterattacking. We think our body is attacking us, our body and mind. So we are defending and counterattacking. We think other living entities are attacking me, so I am defending and counterattacking. This mood that I have anything to be afraid of, that there's any cause for fearfulness. So many bad things happened in the past. So many bad things will happen in the future. I don't have any security. I don't know if people are really my friends. I don't know if I'm going to have this or that. This illusion puts us in a position of always defending. And this defending puts us into a state of conflict with the material energy, with our own body and mind, and with other living entities, which then gives rise to the three miseries, because we're in conflict with them. We're fighting them. So how do people try to cure their anxieties? Well, they try to cure their anxieties. Prabhupada talks about here by following the laws. There's a talks about how the material world is like a jail, and if you're already in jail and you break the laws further, you'll be in prison longer. But Prabhupada also says that everyone's in anxiety either by breaking or without breaking the laws of nature. So some people think, okay, the way that I'll be free from anxiety is I'll be a perfectly pious person. I'll just always follow the laws. And that person could do that either in the modes of passion or the mode of goodness. They could do it in the mode of passion for prestige, and they could do it in the mode of goodness just because it's the right thing to do. But unfortunately, that doesn't work. Just following the laws of the illusion doesn't remove the fearfulness because you're still an illusion. Then you're always going to worry about, do I know what the laws are? Do I understand them properly? Am I following them properly? Am I going to mess up? Now, even if you try to be a perfectly law-abiding citizen, you could mess up. Happened to King Riga. He was such a pious person, and there was a mess up that he didn't have any way of preventing. He gave a bunch of cows to a brahmana, and one cow wandered away and got in the herd of some, got back with his cows, and he gave away the same cow again. And so both the brahmins were furious at him. And because he was still playing the game of illusion, he was subject to the laws of illusion. So just always perfectly following the rules, and that's risky business. Risky business. So one's always going to be afraid. Right? So that's one solution, always follow the rules. Another solution people have is to break the rules. They think, okay, well, the material nature is what's making me fearful. Let me conquer let me become a criminal. Somebody who's really always worrying about money, they may take the illegal means to earn money, and then I think that way they won't have any anxieties anymore. And I won't have to worry about my boss and my coworkers, I'll just become a thief or a gambler. But then you actually have double anxiety, not only anxiety about making money, thieves and gamblers still have to work hard, by the way, but then you're always in anxiety that you're going to get caught by the government. and you're going to be punished. And universally speaking, there's no question of that not happening. Yeah, and the Yamaraj doesn't let criminals go free. So we try to become free of our material anxieties by making material adjustments, either pious or impious. Either by trying to be a really pious person or by trying to cheat. Well, this law is giving me anxiety. You know, if a rule is giving you anxiety, your choices are either to try to follow the rule perfectly or to get around the rule. I was thinking how when I was in high school, I hated high school, hated secondary school, couldn't stand it, thought it was so boring. And I thought, well, if I'm a really good student and I follow all the rules, then the teachers will let me do whatever I like. And it actually worked to a large extent. You know, I was a straight-A student, and so the teachers would often let me leave the classroom and work on other projects. And other students, they thought, oh, high school's terrible. Let me just skip school. Let me go down to the beach. Let me not do my homework. And so those are the two ways of trying to get around the anxiety. One is trying to be so good that you get privileges. And the other is being so bad that you try to get yourself out from under the anxiety. But neither one works. I mean, I was always still in anxiety. Am I going to be able to get an A? You know, you got to work really hard to do that. And you got to worry about it a lot. And the kids who were always skipping school and breaking the rules, they were also in anxiety. So materially, it's like that, because neither one of them gets you out of the illusion, you know. You're still in the illusion that I'm this body. Therefore, Prabhupada starts off here, material knowledge means ignorance of the knowledge of one's own self. Material knowledge means either knowledge about how to play by the rules or knowledge of how to break the rules and try not to get caught. That's what material knowledge amounts to. Most material knowledge is how to play by the rules. You know, how does the material nature work so that I can try to control it? But it's all knowledge of illusion. I mean, we're not against, you have to have some material knowledge. We're not against material knowledge. We're not saying, you know, drive a car without taking driving lessons. But if you think that driving lessons is going to remove you from anxiety, is going to solve the problems of life, then you're cool. You think just knowing about physics and chemistry and mathematics, which one should know. I mean, Srila Prabhupada was a chemist. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a judge. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was a mathematician and astrologer. Maharaj Pariksit was so trained in material subject matter about ruling the kingdom. We're not against material subject matter, but material subject matter in and of itself is not going to solve any problem at all. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says it makes you like an ass. All right, then that's the material solution. Pious and impious. Then there's the so-called spiritual solution. Where a person thinks, oh yeah, actually the problem is that I think that I'm this body. And I think that this world is real. And I think that this world is the source of my happiness. And if I can understand myself, na jayate miyate vakadache, na yam bhutva bhavita vana bhiha, ajo na jashashvita yam pranaya, na hanyate hanyumane shuyaya, I'm eternal. I can't be withered by the wind. I can't be burnt. I can't be dried. I can't be any cut in pieces. I don't have anything to do with this world. All right, let me go for spiritual life. But they don't really want to take up the process for spiritual life. They want something cheap. They want an imitation. Just like we all know that fruit is healthy for you, right? So in the supermarket, you can buy fake fruit juice. Comes in big gallon containers. Got some color and flavor. And it says, you know, juicy juice or something. And sometimes it has 10% fruit juice, and sometimes it has no fruit juice. Sometimes it's all just some chemical approximation. So you know drinking juice is healthy, but you don't want to spend the money for the real juice. You want to spend only $1.50. So you get the, you know, juicy juice. Problem is that the juicy juice doesn't give you those health benefits and could even make you sick. That's the problem. So there's also cheating processes, and there's cheating processes even at the level of Bhagavatam. You know, there's all kinds of cheating processes. Some cheating processes are just some out and out made up religion. Well, I sat down and meditated and I had my own realization and I'm starting a new religion. So some cheating processes are like that. And some cheating processes, people take a bona fide religion and water it down. So, you know, you've got some kind of juicy juice that don't have any juice in them. It's all chemicals. And then you've got other juicy juice that's got 10% juice. There's 10% juice in there. But it's so watered down, 90% water and chemicals, you don't get any benefit from the juice, from the actual the real juice that's in there. So people may even take the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada calls them ridiculous, greedy fellows. They may take the Bhagavatam, which gives one the key to freedom from anxiety. And they may present it in a devious way, just so they can make money, Prabhupada says, to maintain an establishment of material enjoyment, so they can increase the illusion. They're actually using the means to get out of illusion to increase the illusion. Amazing. So that's an apparent spiritual process. Therefore, Ishopanishad says, knowledge is dangerous. And ignorance masquerading as knowledge is more dangerous. Right? So at least material knowledge looks like material knowledge. If someone says you're going to get free from anxiety by taking this vitamin pill, by working out at the gym, by studying this relationship manual, by getting a good education and a good job, by giving a lot in charity, or by taking intoxication. So someone tells you you're going to become free of anxiety through those means. Those are obviously material means. And if I say, oh, you're going to get free from anxiety by hearing my recitation of the Bhagavatam, that's not so obviously material. So it's more dangerous. So what is the actual cure? The actual cure, Prabhupada says, there is self-realization. Not just philosophy. Rajavidya Rajaguyam. Pratyaksha bhagamam dharmam. Experience. Brahma bhuta prasanatma na sochachina kanchati sama sarveshu bhuteshu madhvati mabhateshanam. How do you get to na sochachina kanchati? You have to come to the Brahma bhuta platform. It's not just saying, okay, na jayate mi te vakadachya, oh yeah, yeah, I'm at this body. But what is one experiencing? It ultimately comes down to experiencing. Therefore, Prabhupada says one judges our spiritual realization through our own experience. Just like when you're eating, you get nourishment, satisfaction, and relief from hunger. Naturally, it's concomitant parts of real eating. And there's just no substitute for that. There's no substitute for that. Just going through the motions of rituals, just joining a spiritual organization, you know, just putting little angel figurines on your wall. That's not going to solve the problem. One has to actually realize oneself. Jeto Dharpanam Arjunam. Right now we're looking in the mirror and all we're seeing is the false self. We're in materialistic consciousness. We're just seeing the body and the mind. We're not seeing the real self. Therefore, the anxiety is not going to stop. But one has to become self-realized. One has to wake up The only cure for a bad dream is to wake up. There's no other cure. You're going to adjust the dream. Ultimately, you have to wake up. And not just talk in the dream about waking up. One has to actually wake up. And this is why the Brahmins and the sages are talking about the evidence that Maharaj Pariksit has become enlightened or awakened, that he's given up fearfulness and material attachment. Material attachment, in this case for Maharaj Pariksit, did mean also externals. He gave up eating, sleeping, drinking water, his royal dress, his royal responsibilities. But it could also mean that one continues in that position, but without attachment. Attachment means I'm thinking these are the source of my happiness. That's what we mean by material attachment, which then leads to fearfulness because they're all temporary and unsteady. So the symptom, one of the symptoms of self-realization, is that one's happiness is not dependent anymore on one's external situation. One's happiness is not dependent on one's bodily or mental health, on one's relationship with other living entities, or on what is happening with the forces of nature. One's happiness is within. As Krishna says in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, to relish and rejoice in the self. Because when one realizes oneself, guess what? One loves oneself. Oneself is really wonderful. It is relishable and rejoiceable. Why? Because we're part of Krishna. Mamai vamso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Just hearing this morning, Bhakti Mata Thakur was saying, Radha Krishna is the soul of the soul. So realizing oneself includes realizing Krishna. One can't realize oneself independent of realizing Krishna. One can't realize Krishna independent of realizing oneself. Recently, some devotee scholars were saying, if the spiritual body is intrinsic to the soul, then why don't Brahman-realized persons see their spiritual body? Because they're no longer covered by the modes of nature. And one of the answers is that one sees oneself in relationship to the degree to which one sees Krishna. If one sees Krishna only as light, then one sees oneself also only as a particle of light. And then Mayena Patrena. Therefore, the devotee is asking the Lord to remove his effulgence, to see him clearly. So self-realization and God-realization go together. It's interesting. At least on one occasion, Prabhupada was asking devotees how they preached. And the devotees started talking about how they preached, about the existence of God. Prabhupada says, no, you start with preaching about how you're not this body. Start with preaching about spiritual realization. So why does self-realization bring fearlessness? Because then you know, I have nothing to do with this. It's nothing to do with me. You know, if somebody's getting in some big argument someplace, but you don't have any relationship with them, anything to do with them, and there's no question of any harm from them, it's easy to be detached and fearless. And what does that have to do with me? So none of these things in this world that we deal with have anything to do with me. Whether this body is sickly or healthy, whether this body gets the food, nice food or not nice food, nice clothes, not nice clothes, whether people say nice things about this body and mind or they say nasty things about this body and mind, none of that has anything to do with me. It's irrelevant. Like my car, you know, if my car is here or there or people are criticizing my car or praising my car. I read a really funny story someone sent me the other day. True story. This guy's walking down the street and he sees this really nice red convertible and he's looking at this car. It stopped at a stopplight. He's just looking at the car, Wonder what model and what year that is. That is such a nice car. And some police officer walks down the street. He's also just staring at the car. And the guy says to the police officer, hey, do you know what that is? police officer says, well, what do you mean? He says, what make and model it is. He said, oh, I'm not looking at the car. I was looking at the pretty girl inside the car. So are we looking at the body, or are we looking at the person inside the body? What's the focus of our attention? If we're looking at the body, then we're full of anxiety. When we can actually see ourselves, experience ourselves, there's no cause for any anxiety. I'm eternal. No one can hurt me, ever. I can't be harmed by anything. And all of this so-called harm to this body and mind, which is all basically mental concoction, as Krishna says, it's a dream. It's happening on the field of the mind temporarily. And temporary combinations of the modes of material nature. And that's all. So how does one attain this state of self-realization? Prabhupada says here, Prabhupada mentions two things in particular. He mentions hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and associating with persons such as Sukadeva Goswami. And as we mentioned when reading the purport, that's sort of interesting because they're sort of conflated. I mean, of course, we talked about the book Bhagavat and the person Bhagavat. But of course, this particular person Bhagavat, Sukadeva Goswami, is very intricately related with the book Bhagavat, the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we can say particularly Srimad Bhagavatam and Sukadeva Goswami, but also as a principle, because Prabhupada says, in the association of a learned philosopher like the self-realized soul Sukadeva Goswami, the great son of Srimad Vyasadeva. So the association with self-realized souls. Shabdev says, just like association with materialistic people binds us, so association with the great souls, Dwara is the door, Mukte, to freedom. And what does association with them mean? Hearing and following their instructions. Then it's something genuine. So deep hearing, not something official. Okay, I'm reading the Bhagavatam. Oh, Krishna's dancing with the gopis. I mean, we want to read how Krishna's dancing with the gopis, certainly. But as part of the deep relishing and worshiping, to really imbibe what the Shastra is saying. I mean, in this one purport today, there's so many sentences that are so deep. We can get into this with first sentence. Material knowledge means ignorance of the knowledge of one's own self. Or without self-realization, philosophy is dry speculation or wasting time and energy. In so many of these sentences, we can go into deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper understanding. And association with a devotee, of course, any association with a devotee, Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Shastrakoi, Lava Matu, Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Siddhi. Even a Lava Matu, even an 11th of a second association with a pure devotee can bring Sarva Siddhi, all perfection. We should try, however, for our association with a devotee also to be deep, to really hear from that devotee, serve that devotee with affection. Follow the instructions of that devotee, not just, oh, jai, jai, jai. Okay, chant 16 rounds. Right? I know of at least one instance like that, you know, where someone went to Srila Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, I'm prepared to follow whatever you say. Prabhupada said, then chant 16 rounds. I don't want to do that. So that association with a devotee means following the instructions of that devotee. Mahajana Yena Gatasapanta. They're showing us the path. And by associating with great devotees and reading the Shastra, what happens? We're in touch with the reality. We're coming into the light. As we're in touch with the reality, we become attracted to the reality. We start seeing the great souls and say, wow, that person's actually fearless. And then we become detached from the false advertising. You know, the picture of the guy who's taking the vitamin pills and working out at the gym who looks fearless in the advertisement. But when you actually get to meet him, you see that he's also full of anxiety. I also read another really funny true story. This young athletic guy is walking down the street, just coming out of the gym. You know, he's walking in his exercise clothes. And some really, really old man coming toward him with a walker, you know, hunched over, taking one step at walker one at a time. True story. And the old man, he sees the young man, and he gets this big smile on his face. You can see half his teeth are missing. And he says, 1959, 1959. And the young man kind of looks at him, huh? And the old man says, I looked just like that in 1959. So when we see the people who've attained real fearlessness, then we're able to see, by contrast, that the people who say, oh, you can become fearless just by being healthy and strong, that it's a sham. It's temporary. It's an illusion. By associating with the reality, we start to be able to discern the difference between reality and illusion. By contrast, you know, by association with Srila Prabhupada, one can understand the difference between a genuinely self-realized soul and charlatan, but to speak of materialist, was immediately obvious. When I was first decided to become serious about Krishna consciousness, I was in college, and there were so many other spiritual groups, but the difference was obvious, what was real, what was not real. So we'll attain the state of fearlessness by deep, genuine association with Shastras and Sadhus on a deep, heartfelt level, not associating with them just so people can think that we're religious and pious. That's an emotive passion. Not associating with them so we can convince ourselves I'm a good person, which is an emotive goodness. But actually trying to imbibe what is their mood. And if we deeply associate with the Shastras and the Sadhus, then what we will come to see is that I'm really not part of this world. And we'll come to surrender. Mame kam sharanam vraja. We'll come to surrender, which is seeing Krishna as our maintainer and Krishna as our protector. You know, yogakshema vaham yaham. If Krishna is my maintainer and Krishna is my protector, and I'm an eternal being who can't be hurt by anything, then what is the question of fearfulness? How could there be any fear? And then there can be happiness. Krishna says, how can there be happiness without peace? What does peace mean? Peace means the absence of fear. Now, how does one do this practically? To spend some time every day in hearing and the association of sadhus. Quality time, not official time, quality time, with depth, with a willingness to be changed, with a willingness to be purified, with a willingness to have one's illusions stripped away, with a willingness to see the truth. Even if the first aspects of seeing the truth are very uncomfortable. So the first aspects of seeing the truth are, I've been in a false situation for billions of years. And I've been suffering needlessly. There's no reason for me to suffer. I've chosen to suffer this fearfulness. I've chosen it. So that's a very uncomfortable thing to see. All of my problems are self-inflicted, without reason, out of foolishness. So that's one of the first truths that one sees when one starts to come into the light, and that is uncomfortable. None of us like to see how foolish we are. So one has to be willing to see the truth, has to be open. Open mind, open heart, and open will. And to practice seeing that Krishna is my maintainer and protector. To make a conscious effort to practice that. That doesn't mean I sit around the house all day and do nothing, thinking that Krishna is just going to send me a check in the mail. But it means that emotionally, I'm dependent on Krishna. I don't make any emotional investment in the things of illusion. I do the things in this world as part of my service to Krishna. I'm always meditating. I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm doing this for Srila Prabhupada. I'm doing this for my guru. I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm doing this to please the acharyas. And Krishna will take care of me. Have that be our meditation. Krishna is taking care of me. Krishna always has been taking care of me. I can never be hurt. And I'm doing my duties not to maintain my body. I'm doing my duties not because I'm trying to get some secure position in this world of enjoyment. I'm doing my duties to please Krishna. And one can only have this mentality if one is regularly hearing and regularly in the association of sadhus. You can't just do it artificially. You can't just basically have a materialistic life and say, okay, now I'm going to meditate on how everything I'm doing is service, and I'm going to be able to have a mood that Krishna is maintaining and protecting. That just doesn't work. You can't do it. But if we're regularly hearing from the Shastra, deep hearing, and we're regularly having deep association with sadhus, association with sadhus also doesn't necessarily mean that our physical bodies are in the same room. Just like reading the Shastra doesn't just mean I pick up a book and open it and, you know, read the words. Association with sadhus, again, means hearing, following, serving. That can be sadhus who are presently on the planet, sadhus who are not presently on the planet. So many ways. If we're doing that, and then we take that spiritual strength and we make an effort to put it into practice throughout the day. I'm cleaning my body so I can be a proper servant of Guru and Krishna. I'm eating so that I can be a proper servant of Guru and Krishna. I'm making money to support my family because that's the service that Krishna has given me. And then one will start to realize oneself. One will start to have direct, practical experience. I'm not part of this world. And one's spiritualness will start to decrease. If one is in this process and is still constantly in anxiety about everything, then one's not in this process properly. You know, this ridiculous, greedy fellow can't be talking about us. We've got to be careful. Prabhupada says, you know, if you say you're eating, but you're not getting any nourishment, then either you're not really eating, or you have some parasites. And not really eating means just like chewing gum, just like these false Bhagavatam reciters. And parasites means one's committing offenses. So this is our goal, actually. Of course, this is just the beginning stage of our goal. Fearlessness and self-realization. That's really just the threshold of what we want to achieve, prema pumarthi maham. We want to achieve the full blossoming of our self-realization. But at least we should be coming to a platform where we're more and more fearless, where we have more and more courage. Fearless means courage and faith and trust. And we should be experiencing that in our lives. But I trust. I trust that I'm a soul and that Krishna is taking care of me on every level, even on my material level. And I don't, the only anxiety I have, probably there's something amazing here, which we're just going to touch on. Srimad Bhagavatam gives us a chance to change the quality of anxiety from matter to spirit. Spiritual anxiety? Yes, when I come to see that I'm a soul, my only anxiety is Krishna happy? Is Guru happy? Am I doing my service expertly to please Krishna? That kind of anxiety is above peace. It's above peace. It's an anxiety of love that brings happiness. It's not an anxiety based on illusion. It's an anxiety based on reality. And being based in reality is higher than peace. Peace is already included in it. The platform of peace is already surpassed. So therefore, it doesn't have the quality of material anxiety. Rather, it just has the effect of polishing the blissful love between the devotees and the devotees and Krishna. So, such a nice purport today. I have a few questions.
Okay, I've unmuted everybody on free conferencing. So wherever you are, on Skype or free conferencing, wherever, if you have any questions or comments, go ahead.
Mother Irma, I'd like to ask a question. Lovely class, by the way. Thank you, as always. We talked a lot today about fearlessness and the virtues, how wonderful it is to finally come in that position, approach it. But yet, at the same time, we know there's a healthy component to fearfulness. I was just reading yesterday, Prabhupada was talking in one purport, saying that we should fear the material nature. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna advises Arjuna, dukkha doshana darshanam, that we should see the miseries of this world and understand them. So how do we make that transition? How do we use fearfulness to achieve fearlessness, and how do we progress along that path and actually transition?
I just thought about Winston Churchill. He said, the only thing we need to fear is fear. The only thing we should be afraid of is being afraid. That's all.
Okay. Next question.
In other words, if I see my mind or my consciousness going to fear, I pull it back to reality. Don't allow my mind and my consciousness, if the mind is saying, worry about this, worry about this, worry about this, right? No. And not going to allow my consciousness to go there even for a moment. Therefore, one could say that I'm afraid of it.
But our stage, say, for example, it might be healthy to look forward into the Kali Yuga and see how terrible things will get and to meditate upon, you know, what is the alternative and to see in reality the fearful, how fearful this material world is, how ghastly it is. It
as
seems
long
that
as
could become an impetus.
Is steeped in the present. And how do I behave now in this moment? What is my connection with Krishna now in this moment? If my consciousness is future oriented, I don't. My connection with Krishna is broken. Or if it's past oriented. Krishna's here with me now. Krishna's in my heart now. In his name now, here with me now.
What was the prayer that you quoted from Bhaktivinoda Thakur about the future and the past, living in the present? I'm a little bit poetically challenged, and when you say it real poetically, I miss it.
Past that sleeps and ne'er the future dream at all, but bear with times that are with thee and progress we shall call. It's actually a Krishna conscious version of a famous materialistic poem that he wrote.
But it goes deeper than that. It's Sahagrahi Vaishnav soul. It goes right to the soul level.
Yes, because when you're on the soul level, you must be in the present. Now, that doesn't mean you don't do anything in the present that's related to past and future. But your consciousness is very rooted in this particular moment. You know, if somebody's tried to kill me in the past, so in the present, I'm going to remember that and not, you know, go in the same room with them. But my consciousness is in the present. Or if I'm going to go to India for Karti, so one of the things I may need to do now is call the airline about the ticket that I'm buying for a week from now. So I may do something now that's related to the future or related to the past, but my consciousness is in the present. My investment is in this moment, because this moment is all that really exists. In the spiritual world, it's always the present. And this illusion of past, present, and future is the beginning of material life. It's the first thing. First aspect of material creation is this concept of past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. And one of the elements of illusion is being absorbed in the past and the future. Of the two, the future is the more dangerous because it's the least real. It actually never exists. So the question is, how am I relating to Krishna now, right now, not even today, this moment? Like Lord Brahma says to Krishna after the stealing of the cowherd boys, he says, I see you as Narayan, I see you before me, and I feel you within my heart. Do I feel Krishna within my heart now? Do I have at least some sense of who I am now? Am I absorbed in what I'm doing right now as something that's service for Guru and Krishna? Whatever I'm doing right now, it's not really very important. It's important in the sense that I have a duty to engage my psychophysical nature. So I should try to be doing things now that are in accord with the body and mind that I have, because that's Krishna's instruction. But what I'm doing in the ultimate sense, the details of what I'm doing in the ultimate sense, are not really very important. What's important is, am I doing in the seva? Whether I'm buying a ticket that I'm going to use 2 months from now, or looking at a house I might buy in the future, those are future-oriented things. Whether I'm reading in the Bhagavatam about the effects of Kali Yuga thousands of years from now, how am I responding to that right now? So when I'm reading about how Kali Yuga is going to get worse and worse, am I responding to that right now by deepening my relationship with Krishna right now?
It's nice.
Another way of looking at it also is we take care of things that we can take care of, things that are out of our control. It's better not to spend too much time on it as a source of anxiety. You know, it's just wasted energy.
Yes, that's another way of explaining it. Because the only thing that's really under my control, the only thing that's under my control, is to what extent am I connecting with Krishna right now? That's really all I can control. I can't control anything else. You know, I have some part in other things, but it's a very small part. Can I, you know, do I have control over whether I can see and hear and move my arm? I mean, no, not absolutely. But I do have control over, am I doing my utmost to connect with Krishna right now? That should be my only anxiety. That should be a loving anxiety. like Prabhupada says here, from material to spiritual anxiety. You know, if you're with somebody that you deeply love, and I hope all of us have at least in our life had or have somebody that we really deeply and intensely love, that we know what that feels. So when you're madly in love with somebody, and that's not just conjugal relationships. One can be deeply in love on a friendship level or deeply in love on a parental level also. But when you're deeply in love with somebody, there's some anxiety about being connected with them. But it's sweet. You know, if you're not with them, you're always thinking about when will you be with them. When you're with them, you're relishing your repartee and your conversation. It's not just boring. Oh yeah, I have this relationship. It's just there. I can count on it. You know, like the old married couple who just, they know the other person's there and they don't even really do anything to keep their relationship going. They're just there. No, not like that. We don't want that kind of relationship with Krishna. We want there to be some touch of spiritual anxiety. But it's part of the sweetness. So that's what we can be doing right now. That's under our control. And everything else is more or less not under our control. What to speak of the future or the past? I mean, I can't do anything about the past. Nothing. Absolutely nothing about the past. And the future never exists. Never the future. And as you get there, it's not the future anymore. So all I can do is my present. Can I be in yoga in the present? So that's enough. If I do that, then I get everything.
Can I add something to this?
Sure.
I had a translator years ago, and I was doing some photography at B.G. Sharma's gallery, and this translator came from one of the Brahmin families that takes care of the Raman deities, and he, through his family, he was going to Gujarat. And it was very similar to these Srimad Bhagavatam Saptahas. I think he was reading from Gopal Champu and giving some commentary, but he was telling me, Doug, that you wouldn't believe it. These people offer you cars, you know, all this money, you know, so it becomes a money thing. Mm-hmm. So it affects the presentation, obviously, you know, when you want to please the clientele, you know, you're not trying to awaken them to some kind of Krishna consciousness. You're just giving them some kind of experience that they want, so they'll give you money.
Right.
Yes, that's what Prabhupada was against that.
Yes, it's actually another discussion we can have on how do we distinguish a professional reciter from a devotee reciter. I don't think we have time to get into it in depth. One is an obvious way is what is the reciter doing with their rest of their time? So, you know, if I go and give a Bhagavatam recitation and then when it's over, I'm smoking and drinking and et cetera, then it's obviously just business for me.
Right.
You know, what kind of a person am I in general? Another thing definitely relates to money, but it's interesting that there are at least some times when Srila Prabhupada would refuse to go give a lecture unless people were going to pay for it. So there were times that Prabhupada was invited to speak in various places, and he would say, unless they're going to give some donation, we shouldn't go. And I see that as a similar principle to book distribution, where Prabhupada was not so fond of giving away books for free. He said, if people don't pay for it, they won't value it. But of course, if somebody is giving you something, you know, if someone's giving you some donation in exchange for your service, even if the donation they're giving you is just a place to stay and something to eat, it's very tricky because you can very easily fall into the mood of wanting to please on a material level the people who are giving you some material thing. And it's a very fine line. I'd say there are several ways to avoid that because, and it needs to be avoided, because the renunciate preachers do depend on the donations of the people that they serve. That's how they live. I mean, there are ways of living like Madhavendra Puri, who only ate food that came of his own accord. He didn't even beg for food. But even Mahaprabhu was begging for food when he traveled in South India. And it's the normal way that the renunciates maintain themselves is through the donations of the people in general. And in fact, a jagya without remuneration to the priest is in the mode of ignorance. So if I'm getting spiritual knowledge and help from someone and I don't help to maintain that person, that's a jagya that's in the mode of ignorance. Sankirtan Jagya should also involve in the integration to the priest. And I see that, you know, some devotees get that and some devotees don't get that. You know, I know myself when I travel and preach, some places say, I'm sorry, we won't even, you know, contribute to the airfare of the preachers. It's like, oh, okay. You know, how do they expect you to come? They expect you to come by mantra. And then you can understand they're not really valuing. It's not a proper exchange. So that actually has to be there. The people in general, and especially the people who are benefiting, they're required to maintain those who are giving spiritual knowledge. And that's true even if the person giving spiritual knowledge is a householder brahmana, especially if that's their main occupation. So how does a teacher of Krishna consciousness avoid getting into this compromised professional mentality? There's several ways. One is that one only takes what one actually needs and one redistributes the rest. That's actually one of the injunctions. That whatever charity one gets, one takes what one actually needs, one keeps one's needs very simple, and one uses the rest directly in preaching. Another is to not consider that anything is one's own. Sorry, I'm so stuck. Cold. I know many preachers who don't have any kind of personal money at all. All of their money belongs to Krishna, literally. They don't have a personal bank account. They don't have anything that's their personal property. If they had a last will and testament, they wouldn't have any property to disperse because nothing belongs to them. All of it belongs to the project that they work for. Another, I think, very important thing is for people in the position of receiving donations is never to be dependent on something that's regular. Like a salary. I know one renounced woman who told me that she will never receive regular maintenance from anybody. Even though she has no means of support. So and if somebody says, you know, okay, I'm going to give you $500 a month, you just say no. I won't take it.
Really?
And if things are random, that is much... it's much harder to become compromised. But I think ultimately it's a mentality. These external things help in having that mentality that Krishna is my maintainer. You know, Mr. Patel or Mrs. Smith is not my maintainer. Krishna is my maintainer. But it's definitely easier to have that mentality if you're not in a position where you're literally dependent on somebody, and particularly not one person. That you don't have some sort of sponsor. As soon as you have one particular sponsor, then you become like their pet dogs. And then you become much more interested in pleasing your sponsor than in pleasing Krishna.
What if it's coming from the government?
I'd be careful. You know, of course, the government has basically a responsibility to maintain brahmanas. That's one of the things the government is supposed to be doing with tax money. So the government is supposed to use tax money to give charity to the householder brahmanas and to give charity to the brahmacharis to maintain the schools. Brahmacharis, again, means a young person, a student, and to maintain the vanaprastas and the sannyasis, who are the children of society. So the government has a duty to give that kind of charity. Now, in Vedic times, was that given on a regular basis, like a salary? I don't think so. So the kshatriyas would give in charity at auspicious events, and they would give in charity to people who ran schools and temples. The government also had a responsibility, Prabhupada talks about this many times, to make sure that anyone who said they were a brahmana was a real brahmana, to avoid cheating. To make sure that the persons receiving that charity were not just using it for their own extravagant sense gratification, that they were actually devoted to the absolute truth and they were actually preaching the glories of the Lord. I mean, we read a few purports back where Prabhupada said that many of the brahmanas were not poor in a technical sense because it's whole villages. What does that mean? They'd give them a village. In other words, they'd allow the brahmana to live off the taxes of that village. So in Vedic times, we were just reading a little while ago, there were some brahmanas who were very wealthy in money and gold and land and cows. But they used everything for spiritual benefit of society. They weren't enjoying a life of sense gratification like the Satyas and the Vaishyas. But anyway, we should be careful. One who's living on charity should be careful that they're really using their time and energy for the benefit of humanity. And I think nowadays getting government money, which usually means getting something regular from the government, one can become lazy and say, okay, I'm getting government money, you know, why do I have to be engaged in service?
Could also facilitate service. But I have one other thing that came up in the purport, the idea of fear, increasing fear. And if people go to horror movies and they do all these things, and I think they're just trying to feel alive. You know, they're so dull that it takes something really heavy to make them feel something.
Yes.
And, but the end result is, you know, they become extremely fearful.
It's a poor substitute for prema.
It certainly is.
You know, because Prabhupada talks about that with Arjuna. You know, when Arjuna didn't want to fight and he was fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And his hairs were standing on end and he was quivering and his Bhogandiva was slipping from his hand. And Prabhupada says, I believe in that one of those purports, that these are symptoms either of great ecstasy or great fear. So the poor conditioned souls who aren't experiencing prema, you know, sometimes they want to experience extreme fear as a substitute. Brings out, you know, has some imitative qualities. That your hair was standing on end and you're shaking and shivering and you're crying and, you know, it's their counterfeit prema.
Wow.
Pretty sad.
That's sad.
Pretty unfortunate.
I have a question. The professional reciters of Bhagavatam, is there any benefit that anybody could get from hearing them.
Possible that just because you're in touch with Bhagavatam, that you may get a desire to get it the real way. Of course, just like there may be benefit from offensive chanting. There's at least one place where Prabhupada said the association with a pure devotee is so powerful that even if one's association is offensive, eventually one will get the spiritual result after one is cleared from the offenses. So that's possible. It may take some time. It's like trying to light a fire with wet wood. You know, all you get is smoke. You don't get any heat. You can't cook anything. Now, eventually, your attempts to light a fire may dry out the wood. So it could be that if you hear Bhagavatam from one of these people, that you'll become entranced by some aspect of the Bhagavatam. That entrancement will allow you to see that the person reciting the Bhagavatam is a charlatan, and you'll go for the real thing. In fact, I know of many instances of that. Many. I know of many people who read some bogus translation of Bhagavad Gita that inspired them to find a better translation. And so they ended up with Prabhupada's translation. Or many people who, you know, were worshiping demigods or worshiping Krishna, but with some professional persons and decided they wanted to get the real thing. I mean, we get stories sent to back to Godhead like that all the time. So I think that that's quite common. That, you know, that association with a charlatan inspires you to find association with the real thing.
When I first came to the temple, I had been around the Paramahamsa Yogananda group, and they had a concocted parampara that started with Jesus or Krishna, the deity of Krishna, Jesus, then this deathless yogi, Babaji, then Yukteswar, or Lahiri Mahasaya, Yukteswar, and then Paramahamsa Yogananda. And when I saw the parampara in the ISKCON temple in Rio Piedras, Puerto Rico, immediately I understood I had just seen a bogus parampara. This is the right one.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I like that. That's a very good example. You know, but still we can give some credit to even the charlatan spiritualists that may spark our interest in spirituality. That depends. I mean, frankly, all kinds of things can start us on the spiritual path. Krishna can use anything. What to speak of a charlatan recitation of the Bhagavatam. Some people get an interest in spiritual life because their child dies or they lose all their money. So many.
Could we give any credit to the psychedelic experiences of the 60s that seemed to send, at least apparently on some level, turned many of us to spiritual seekers?
I like what Satsukumar says about that. He says that a lot of the people who came to Srila Prabhupada were people who were so determined to find spirituality that they were literally willing to risk their sanity to do so.
Hmm.
So, you know, taking these psychedelic drugs is dangerous. You may end up a lunatic. Literally. And I think that many of us know persons who lost, literally became mentally ill from taking LSD and these other, you know, drugs, or died.
And it actually, it's not everybody was on the same page taking that intoxication. Some people became spiritual seekers. Other people were just mixing alcohol and all this other stuff and just, you know, became druggies.
Well, I think it's the same, you know, one principle
is that people, you know, the people who are willing to do that, were also willing to sacrifice their life for Krishna, especially in the early days of ISKCON. You know, joining the Hare Krishna movement, the people who joined at 26 Second Avenue, there wasn't, materially speaking, much that they were joining. You know, it's very different if you're joining a worldwide society with millions of members and huge temples and the whole infrastructure. You're just joining a little storefront. You know, you're going to sacrifice your whole life for this little thing. It took a lot of faith. It took a lot of risk. I mean, even when I joined the movement in 73, hardly anyone had heard of the Hare Krishna movement. So it took a risk-taking mentality. It's kind of like the people who first came to America from Europe. They were pretty much all heavy risk-taking people. And because of that, you still see a mentality in America today of glorification of the risk taker, the explorer and the astronaut and the inventor are very much an icon in American society. Same with Australia, because those were the ancestors of the people who came here. Even today, many of the immigrants are high risk takers. Even a lot of the illegal immigrants are high risk takers. So to dedicate your life to Krishna involves a big jump. And that's at any time. It involves really a leap of faith. But what to speak of in the early days, when it was such a small, undeveloped society from an external point of view. So I think that's Maharaj's point, that people who are willing to take the risk of taking some of these hallucinogens in order with the aim of a higher consciousness, that was their goal, were also willing to take the risk of joining the Hare Krishna movement for a higher goal. I think in another way that they can be related is that the sorts of experiences one has on these drugs are obviously false. They give a parody of higher consciousness. And when you chant Hare Krishna, you get a genuine experience of higher consciousness. And the comparison is very obvious. This is an example that I use a lot with how we all have evidence that we experience genuine Krishna consciousness, at least sometimes. The quality of the experience is very different. I mean, we can all hear the difference between somebody speaking over a microphone and somebody speaking loudly without artificial amplification. There's a difference in quality. And it's hard to exactly pin it down in words, how we know the difference. You know, I can tell the difference between real food and fake food. Exactly how can I tell the difference? It's hard to describe it. But there's a family that I stay with in Slovenia who have been raw food eaters for like 15 years, and they grow pretty much all their own food. And, you know, when you're eating there, fresh food that's just, you know, organically grown in the backyard, I mean, talking about local, right in their backyard, picked an hour ago, there is a quality difference. And again, how do you describe it? The flavors are richer, the smells are richer, the food is more tender. But I'll tell you, you can tell the difference. And once you've eaten tree-ripened fruit, you know, artificially ripened fruit just doesn't taste the same. So I think, you know, the people who are eating this artificially ripened fruit, if they had any contact with Krishna consciousness, then it was something that much more easily to take up. Oh, yeah, that's the real thing that I was just getting an imitation of. And that doesn't mean that we would suggest that anybody take drugs as a way, as a bridge to spiritual life. Just like somebody may get involved with spiritual life because they get in a car accident, but we don't suggest that people have car accidents. So I think in retrospect, that each of us who've come to spiritual life can see how somehow we interpreted and used whatever our life circumstances were in order to bring us closer to Krishna. But other people can have those same life circumstances and not go to Krishna. So we don't give credit to the life circumstances themselves. We give credit to how we chose to interpret them and some mercy that we got from this life or previous life or who knows. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Hare Bol. Thank you so much, yeah. Manaji.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Bol.
Hare Bol, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you.
Thank you, Ramananjaji.